Welcome to the David Yosefon Podcast. I'm David Yosefon. I'm the Peter Canisius S.J. Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law. You can find all of my writings, podcasts, and other work on my website at davidyosefon.com. There you will also find contact information if you want to drop me a line. In this episode of the podcast, I wanted to provide an audio version of my article, Moby Dick as Corporate Catastrophe, Law, Ethics, and Redemption. This article was published in 2021 in the University of Cincinnati Law Review. Now, as I read this article, I will, of course, not be reading all of the footnotes. If you want to see the full citations, of course, please find the article through my website. And now, Moby Dick as Corporate Catastrophe, Law, Ethics, and Redemption. Introduction. Some works of art suffuse the culture so deeply that they affect your mind even if you have no direct encounter with them. Moby Dick is such a book. Its influence is everywhere, its power capacious, even mystical. Its deep themes are involved in your thinking about the world and can be redeployed to change your thinking about it, whether you have read the novel or not. My ambition here is to use Moby Dick as a vehicle through which to interrogate core features of American corporate law and excavate some of the deeper lessons about the human soul that lurk behind the pasteboard mask of the law's black letter. The inquiry yields an illuminating vantage on the ethical consequences of corporate capital structure, the law of corporate purpose, the meaning of voluntarism, the ethical stakes of corporate fiduciary obligations, and the role of lawyers in preventing or facilitating corporate catastrophe. Pursuing the corporate law dimensions of Moby Dick will also yield valuable insights about the novel itself, how it works, and why it works so well. Quote, "You know Moby Dick before you know it," Jonathan Lethem. "And yet you may not know, as I did not know the first time I read it, some key particulars which, in order to ripen what follows, I must spoil from the start. So let us begin this account of corporate catastrophe by making explicit what Herman Melville saves for last. Everyone dies at the end of Moby Dick, or nearly everyone. The two survivors are the narrator, Ishmael, who lived to tell us the tale, and the white whale, who heaps and tasks us still." Raising the whale in corporate waters. References made to Moby Dick in 125 state and federal cases. It comes up in underlying facts. Many bars, restaurants, and boats in this country are named Moby Dick. And these are the loci of fights, accidents, and other legal strife. Jurists also invoke the novel in their legal analysis. It is referenced to rue the burdensome length of a proceeding. The book is long. It is invoked to depict a party's dogged pursuit of some outcome, especially vengeance. You know why. It is incanted to explain that a case is really about something weightier than a superficial reading of the pleadings would suggest, e.g., defendant, quote, "a defendant attempts to cast this litigation as little more than a liquor license case. That characterization is about as accurate as would be one that described Moby Dick as being a book about a white whale," close quote. In many cases, the book's majestic prose is borrowed to finely express what the law is. Not previously knowing it, you and I will now never forget that the owner of real property along the shoreline loses title to land that is worn away by, quote, the sledgehammering seas, the inscrutable tides of God, close quote, Moby Dick. The book is even cited as authority in a few cases concerning the law of whaling. Moby Dick thus roams expansively over the law's oceans. Yet never has it been raised in the sea where one might surely expect to find it. The law of fiduciary duty, the law of loyalty, the law of good faith and bad. Despite the fame and influence of the book and the vibrancy of these themes at its core, it has not been used in case law to explicitly explicate agency or corporate law principles. Neither is there scholarship directly on point. Moby Dick was overlooked by literary elites in Melville's day. The juridical and academic establishment in corporate law continues to miss it. Our understanding of corporate law has suffered from this lapse, and our understanding of the novel has perhaps suffered from it too. Here, I take up the chase. The nature of the firm hunting whales. Part of what is so engrossing about Moby Dick is how strange, even unthinkable, the 19th century whaling industry seems to modern readers. The ludicrous truth is captivating. A primary source of fuel in the industrializing world of the 19th century was whales, captured and killed for their oil. Footnote, for some readers, revulsion at the atrocity of whale hunting from a humanitarian or ecological standpoint may trigger a rejection of any invitation to use Moby Dick to grapple with other intellectual or moral themes. I urge such readers to continue precisely because of that revulsion. The agony of the whales, their near extinction, and the ecological devastation of whaling are inexorably connected to the corporate law dynamics under review here. Understanding that corporate law connection is crucial to reversing that devastation and saving the whales. Back to the text. Whale oil fueled the growth of capitalist America by greasing its factory machines and, perhaps more importantly, illuminating its nights. Production and consumption, legal work, the whole stuff of truck barter and exchange carried on through the 19th century evening as relentlessly as it did the day by light of whale oil. This changed only when it became more efficient to seek oil underground by building spouts above it instead of seeking oil underwater by chasing spouts across it. Whaling was a capital-intensive industry. Large ships were built and expensively provisioned, then crewed with around 30 men and boys who would undertake a voyage that would last years, extending to the farthest reaches of the world, in pursuit of whales that would be hunted in smaller boats launched off the ship. Captured whales were stripped and boiled down in fireworks maintained on board the ship, and their oil was then stored in large casks until the ship returned to its home port. Whaling was risky business. Many men were killed by whales or in other accidents at sea. Ships would get wrecked in the typhoons that stalked the best whaling waters. Pirates would chase down successful whaling ships and steal their hard-gained oil. After a many years venture, a ship might come back clean with no oil in it because no whales were found or none captured or the bounty was stolen. But if a ship came back safe and sound, full of oil, there was tremendous profit in it. Footnote. In the mid to late 19th century, a single captured whale might yield oil and bone worth $2,000 to $3,000 at a time when the mean family income was $600 to $800 per year in the United States. See Robert Ellickson, A Hypothesis of Wealth-Maximizing Norms, Evidence from the Whaling Industry, 1989. Because of the industry's capital demands and riskiness, whaling ships were not usually wholly owned by a single entrepreneur. Rather, each ship would have numerous investors, and whaling investors diversified their interests across many ships. Melville emphasizes this organizational form early in his novel. When Ishmael is first interviewing for a position on the Pequod with the ship's promoters, Captains Bildad and Peleg, he notes, "Bildad and Peleg were among the largest owners of the vessel. The other shares, as it is sometimes the case in these ports, being held by a crowd of old annuitants, widows, fatherless children, and chancery wards, each owning about the value of a timberhead, or a foot of plank, or a nail or two in the ship. People in Nantucket invest their money in whaling vessels the same way that you do yours in approved state stocks, bringing in good interest." Close quote. By highlighting that the Pequod is a corporate enterprise held by passive investors, Melville structures the story at its core in terms of fiduciary relationships. Captain Ahab's pursuit of the white whale is not the story of private hubris gone wrong. It is the story of corporate catastrophe. Melville is given occasion to grapple deeply with conflicts of individuality and loyalty, autonomy and compulsion, excess and restraint, because to tell his story, he must confront an emergent organizational form that evokes these tensions within the individual human heart and forces them to play out across our relationships. In this, we witness the synergies of institutional, legal, literary, and ethical innovation. Moby Dick is given life by a corporate conception, and then it returns the favor by breathing deeper meaning into the corporate form. Footnote: compare Jack London, The Sea Wolf, 1904, concerning Wolf Larsen, the monomaniacal captain of a sea-hunting schooner who owns his ship outright. London's is a gripping, inspiring tale, but the narrow institutional context makes for a limited exploration of the forms of human life. Captain Larsen is an owner. Captain Ahab, more interestingly, is a manager. Now, Ishmael does not say one way or the other whether the Pequod was literally incorporated. Whaling firms in the 1830s and 1840s were in fact sometimes organized through formal corporate charters. However, most were unincorporated ventures. The modern corporate form did not become widely available to business enterprises in the United States until the late 19th century. I am concerned with using Moby Dick to aid our modern thinking about contemporary corporate law, so I do not struggle here for a neat pairing of my analysis with an historical assessment of the 19th century whaling industry. Nevertheless, it is clear that mid-19th century American whaling did evince many core corporate characteristics, including fractional ownership by diversified shareholders and the separation of ownership and control. While whaling investors did not gain limited liability by dint of their legal form, even 19th century corporations did not always grant shareholders limited liability, whaling investors were mostly on the hook, the harpoon, for what they invested, because the ventures were funded largely with equity, were insured, and because tort liability for maritime activity in that area was scant. For an excellent and technically precise overview of the law and economics of 19th century whaling, see Professor Hilt's Investment and Diversification in the American Whaling Industry, 2007, and his Professor Hilt's Incentives in Corporation, Evidence from the American Whaling Industry. I'm grateful to Professor Hilt for his generosity in corresponding with me on these issues. Back to the text. Purpose and conscience on the Pequod. Among the most important issues in corporate law is what purpose corporate operations are supposed to pursue. On this question, scholars are divided, both as to what the law is and what it should be. Some academics argue that corporate law requires directors to manage corporations solely in the interests of shareholders and forbids the sacrifice of corporate profits in order to serve other ends. Other scholars insist that corporate directors are not required to serve only shareholders, but can instead legitimately attend to other stakeholders or issues, such as workers, consumers, or the environment, even at the expense of shareholder profits. My view is that existing corporate law in the United States requires shareholder primacy, but I think this rule should be changed. Moby Dick gets the law of corporate governance right and sees clearly the stakes of this crucial debate. Footnote, for a full review of this dispute, see my book, Corporate Friction, How Corporate Law Impedes American Progress and What to Do About It. Back to the text. When it came time for Ishmael to negotiate, take or leave, compensation for sailing on the Pequod, Captain Peleg, a manager of the venture, wants to put him down for the 300th lay. This is whaling cont for 1/300th of the ship's total profits. But Peleg's co-manager, Captain Bildad, thinks this is too much to offer the inexperienced Ishmael and wants to give him the 777th lay, 1/777th of the ship's profits. Peleg and Bildad debate the legitimacy of shareholder primacy in the ship's governance. Quote, "Why, blast your eyes, Bildad," cried Peleg. "Thou dost not want to swindle this young man. He must have more than that." Bildad laid down his book and turned solemnly toward him, said, "Captain Peleg, thou hast a generous heart, but thou must consider the duty thou owest to the other owners of this ship, widows and orphans, many of them, and that if we too abundantly reward the labors of this young man, we may be taking the bread from those widows and those orphans. The 777th lay, Captain Peleg." Peleg replies, "Blast ye, Captain Bildad. If I had followed thy advice in these matters, I would afore now had a conscience to lug about that would be heavy enough to founder the largest ship that ever sailed round Cape Horn." Close quote. Who should have the heavier conscience? Captain Bildad, the shareholder primacist, or Captain Peleg, who wants the Pequod's board to govern in a more socially responsible manner? Bildad is a man who contains multitudes. He is at once a pious Christian. He is reading from the Bible, even as Peleg approaches him about Ishmael's wages. And he is a strict adherent to the idea that the Pequod must be run only to maximize shareholder profits. This seeming hypocrisy makes Ishmael wonder how Bildad sleeps at night. He assumes he does it the old-fashioned way. Quote, "Very probably he had long since come to the sage and sensible conclusion that a man's religion is one thing and this practical world quite another." Close quote. Walt Whitman shrugged and had a cozy nap. Quote, "Do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself." Close quote. Song of Myself. But the truth of Bildad's easy slumber is simpler and perhaps more pernicious than this. For the pious Bildad and shareholder primacy theory, there is no contradiction. They are sure that shareholder primacy is the most socially responsible corporate governance system. On their view, the board must govern the corporation strictly on behalf of shareholders in order to give people the incentive to passively invest capital in socially useful enterprises. This gets whale oil to consumers, creates jobs for people like Ishmael, and makes a tax base for the polity. Unlike capital investors, workers and consumers do not need directors' active protection in the boardroom before they will participate in corporate undertakings. Labor can attend to its own interests at the point of production by negotiating terms of employment and threatening to quit if they are mistreated. Consumers control their corporate interests at the cash register or the checkout screen, deciding on what terms they are willing to deal with a firm, if at all. As residual claimants, shareholders only benefit from corporate operations after all other stakeholders have received the benefit of their bargains. Dividends are only paid, if they are paid, once wages, products, and taxes have been delivered. Shareholders are therefore first in the corporate conscience only because they are last at the corporate trough. In this way, shareholder primacy serves society's most vulnerable members, lifting them out of poverty and bringing them delights in ways that superficially more socially conscious systems would not. Captain Bildad suffers neither cognitive nor spiritual dissonance in simultaneously running a dangerous, profit-maximizing extraction industry, paying long lays to his soldiers, his sailors, and maintaining his sincerely held Christian religious convictions. He sleeps very well indeed. Captain Peleg's conscience is rattled at the prospect of paying an unfavorable lay to Ishmael. But sometimes it is a mistake to calibrate conscience by the untutored impulses of the heart, like our eating system, which signals hunger whenever it is in the presence of sugar or fat. Such impulses might have been a useful ethical guide to doing business in earlier epochs of human development. But some instincts must be restrained if we are to flourish under modern institutional arrangements, where, for example, junk food is always available, or where complex capital-intensive production must be effectively orchestrated. In the end, conscience should be dictated by theory, not the other way around. Then again, maybe it is Captain Bildad's satisfied mind that needs the disruptive provocation of theoretical inquiry. Charged with managing firms only to pursue profits for shareholders, faithful directors will work tirelessly to externalize costs wherever possible to workers, consumers, the environment, or whales. Footnote. In surveying the corporate catastrophe of Moby Dick, we must highlight the calamity of the whales. On Nantucket Island, whaling began as a sustainable subsistence activity by the Wampanoag, a Native American tribe, who harvested blubber and bones from whales that washed up on the beach. By the time the Pequod set sail in the mid-19th century, Nantucket whaling firms had to travel thousands of miles from home to hunt because by then industrial whaling had already wiped out the whale populations off the Massachusetts coast. Whales brought nearly to extinction by overfishing is a statistic. But the suffering of any given whale in the course of a hunt is a tragedy. Ishmael tells us that in his era, whales were killed by slicing into their lungs with lances again and again, causing the massive creatures to thrash about in agony, drowning in their own gore until dead. The novel itself is both inspired by the glories of whale hunting and ashamed of its depravity. Advances in petroleum production effectively ended the whale oil industry by the 1890s. But advances in whaling technology and continued global demand for whale products, such as baleen, actually resulted in dramatically increased kills of whales in the early decades of the 20th century as compared to the golden age of whaling depicted in Moby Dick. By the middle of the 20th century, with many species of whales nearing extinction from human predation, serious regulatory restriction of whaling finally broke through. The International Convention for the Regulation of Whaling was established in 1946, and the United States adopted federal statutes in the 1960s and 1970s prohibiting whaling altogether. An international ban on whaling was promulgated through the International Whaling Commission in 1986, which, with exceptions granted for hallowed cultural and religious practices. Today, it is not so much hunting as climate change that threatens the whales. The same thirst for oil that once chased the whales with harpoons now stalks them with rising temperatures in the sea. Climate change is a civilizational threat, and the corporate law dynamics that wrecked the Pequod are at the heart of the human causes of that catastrophe, too. Back to the text. The command to maximize shareholder wealth encourages directors to skimp not only on wages, but also on worker and consumer safety. The claim that non-shareholders can manage their own interests in corporate operations ignores the practical reality that many stakeholders have a limited ability to do so, especially given the firm's motivation to obfuscate on important issues. Proponents of shareholder primacy acknowledge this incentive for directors to exploit others on behalf of shareholders. They insist, however, that this problem should be solved outside of corporate governance through labor law, environmental law, or consumer protection statutes. Shareholder primacy's critics view this as inadequate because they anticipate what has in fact been seen from the 19th century whaling industry through the 21st century technology industry. Directors pursue shareholder profits just as doggedly through governments as they do through production and distribution processes, for example, by working to stunt the development of costly regulation. Critics also emphasize the ways in which shareholder primacy can be culturally destructive. Patriotic conscience, for example, is afforded no place in the shareholder primacy boardroom, not when it conflicts with the bottom line. Firms unhesitatingly export jobs to cheaper labor markets abroad, irrespective of the consequences to domestic workers and national cohesion. From this critical viewpoint, shareholder primacy's merely ostensible coherence has lulled Captain Bildad into an intellectual and moral complacency. As Captain Peleg and Ishmael approached Bildad for the lay negotiation, he was reading aloud a passage from his Bible, quote, "Lay not up for yourself treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt." And that's Matthew 6:19, quoted within Moby Dick. Melville turns this passage into slapstick by italicizing lay, thus putting on the nose the connection between the issue of what lay Ishmael will receive and the biblical injunction against earthly concerns. Slapstick, too, can be instructive. Bildad is consciously, or worse still, unconsciously, using the Bible, a text avowedly sacred to him, to manipulate Ishmael. In the end, he may end up fooling and making a fool of himself, too. Our deep-seated impulse to avoid cognitive dissonance, our driving psychological motive to find alignment between our opinions and our behaviors, makes us a threat not just to others, but to ourselves. The seeming coherence of shareholder primacy has given Bildad a mirage of coherence in his own life. With his Bible in one hand, corporate ledger in the other, peace in his heart, and harmony in his head, dissonance avoidance has made a cartoon of Bildad. If he would let the contradictions dwell in his conscience, if we would let the contradictions dwell in our conscience, we might know ourselves better and turn our slapstick lives to more serious productions. Instead, we collapse everything into coherence and live in a happy fog. But let us neither condescend to the absurd nor be overly righteous in our thinking about who is confused here. The scene works for laughs and as literature and as an adjunct to corporate theory because it finally is not polemical. Good writing can make a reader more confident, but great writing will leave them lost. Melville paints both sides of the corporate purpose debate. And while anyone can find confirmation of their priors in the text, as my preceding paragraphs well show, the honest reader is also confronted with complexity that must in the end leave them uncertain. Novelists do not have the policymaker's responsibility to finally make legal decisions and settle designs with particularity, as must be done. But knowing the complexities in a beautiful way can make us humble about our policy choices and unsanctimonious towards our opponents. Just when you are sure that shareholder primacy has made a mess of everyone involved, this comes. Ishmael brings along his best friend, Queequeg, a Pacific Islander tattooed from head to foot, to sign up with the Pequod 2. Queequeg gives the managers a brief demonstration of his harpooning skill by striking a bullseye through a small tar stain floating in the water off the side of the ship. Captain Bildad quickly offers him the 90th lei, a far better rate than was given to Ishmael. The profit motive is narrow. So narrow that it can sometimes sneak a path right through the worst demons of human nature. Queequeg is judged not by the inked icons on his skin, nor by racist presumptions about his character, but by the content of his harpooning skill. This anti-racist policy is dictated not from Bildad's Bible, nor any conscious humanitarianism, but from the acid bath of the market. Footnote. See Richard Epstein's Forbidden Grounds, arguing that competitive markets reduce racial discrimination more effectively than does government regulation, and Gary Becker's Economics of Discrimination in 1971. Same argument. Back to the text. After settling terms with Ishmael and Queequeg, the pious Bildad does take a quick stab at converting the pagan Queequeg. But Peleg steps in. Now he is the one thinking of the widows and orphans or his own investment. He says it is better to have some shark in a harpooner on a whale hunt and not too much of a Christian outlook. The prophet Maximan thus also saves Queequeg from Bildad's proselytizing. Although then again, the rule of prophet maximization may function here as a censor of good news. As for bad news, there will be plenty to come for the Pequod Incorporated. Shareholder primacy and the sinking of the Pequod. Everyone involved in corporate enterprise, the shareholders, creditors, workers, consumers, the government, wants the corporation to succeed. Yet the interests of these groups are not aligned and are often in tension. One important divergence relates to stakeholder attitudes towards risk. Because the stockholders of the Pequod hold investments spread out across numerous ships, they prefer each individual ship to be managed in a relatively aggressive fashion. Diversified investors do not care so much if any one ship in their portfolio comes back clean, that is empty, or does not come back at all. The real money may be in the high upside of very successful voyages. This institutional design is an integral component of the catastrophe of Moby Dick. The managers of the Pequod knew Captain Ahab well. They knew that on a prior voyage, he had lost his leg to an enraged whale, lost it, we will learn, to Moby Dick. Ahab suffered terribly after that attack. He was fevered and delirious the whole long journey home to Nantucket. Back on shore, he recovered but was changed. Never previously gregarious, Ahab now became deeply, strangely reserved. The Pequod's managers could not fathom exactly what was going on with Old Thunder, as he was known, but they knew he was off. So strange did Ahab seem that in their superstitious ways, the Nantucketers thought he might be, quote, invested with terrors, not entirely underived from the land of spirits and of whales. Close quote. Yet they let it ride. Looking to the high upside that an especially exercised whaling captain might deliver, they put Ahab in charge again of the next voyage of the Pequod. Understand that Ahab was put in command of the Pequod not despite its directors knowing he was twisted, but because of it. Quote, far from distrusting his fitness for another whaling voyage, on account of such dark symptoms, the calculating people of that prudent isle were inclined to harbor the conceit that for those very reasons he was all the better qualified and set on edge for a pursuit so full of rage and wildness as the bloody hunt of whales, close quote, Moby Dick. The shareholder primacy corporation will commodify danger. It will commodify dementedness. It will, for the stockholders, seek to commodify even suspicion of supernatural possession. A charismatic person at the helm of a whaling ship is more likely to return a ship full of sperm than is a cautious one. And investors only need some full ships to offset a number of misspent journeys. I am not reading corporate law into this. Rather, it is incumbent upon us to make this lesson part of our corporate law understanding. What happened on the Pequod, we must predict, is at work in its ways in our modern oil companies, our pharmaceutical concerns, our social media giants, and in our venture capital funds. The risk-preferring posture of shareholders clashes with labor's preference that individual firms be managed carefully, with a risk-averse attitude. Whereas equity investors are diversified, workers have a lumpy stake in their particular job with a specific firm and, compared to shareholders, care more about abject corporate failure and less about high corporate profitability. On the Pequod, as in many workplaces, it is not just jobs that are at stake, but also life, limb, and wellness. Notice that this misalignment of interest bedevils the workers even where the captain is behaving properly. The shareholders are hoping that Ahab's affliction manifests in risky whale hunting. They lose if it instead manifests disloyally in the idiosyncratic pursuit of one weird, dangerous whale. But the ordinary sailors lose either way. Worse than putting Ahab at the helm, the Pequod's directors kept Ahab's off-kilter condition a secret. Quote, through their zeal for him, they had all conspired, so far as in them lay, to muffle up the knowledge of this thing from others. And hence it was that not till a considerable interval had elapsed did it transpire upon the Pequod's decks. Close quote. The directors knew, but they did not tell the crew. In fact, the prudent Ishmael had asked to see Ahab before signing up, thinking it wise to meet a ship's chief executive officer before joining up for such a long and perilous gig. Here, Ishmael was doing what apologists for shareholder primacy expect. Workers attend to their own interests at the point of production, freeing directors to serve the interests of absent, passive shareholders. But as critics of shareholder primacy anticipate, the corporate managers of the Pequod mislead our reasonably prudent narrator about the risks of this venture. Director Peleg does it with ambiguity, that most potent weapon of the manipulator. Ishmael asks to meet Ahab, but Peleg puts him off. Quote, I don't think thou wilt be able at present. I don't know exactly what's the matter with him, but he keeps close inside the house, sort of sick, and yet he don't look so. In fact, he ain't sick, but no, he ain't will either. Anyhow, young man, he won't always see me, so I don't suppose he will see thee. Close quote. This is not the kind of disclosure one would require of a fiduciary, but it is fine for the morals of the marketplace. More than fine, it is a morality which Bildad is obligated in fealty to the shareholders to don in dealing with a common sailor. Footnote, we implies they, and loyalty implies abandonment. In their loyalty to the shareholders, the ship's promoters are disloyal to their friend Ahab. For expected gains, they put Ahab in charge of the ship, disregarding the danger this makes of Ahab to himself. Ahab's disloyalty to the shareholders is bred in the promoters' disloyalty to him, which is motivated by their loyalty to the shareholders. Quote, ah, monstrous, sweet monsters, who spawned the chalk? Close quote. Jack Kerouac, Book of Blues. Back to the text. As for Ishmael, the doe-eyed alchemist of optimism in him turns this ambiguity about Ahab into confirmation, finding in its assay evidence that everything will probably work out all right. He joins up. Capital's risk-preferring approach to corporate governance does not work out in every instance. For any given firm, it may backfire. Ahab's charisma, it turns out, will not be deployed to fill the hull with sperm. For, quote, with the mad secret of his unabated rage bolted up and keyed in him, Ahab had purposely sailed upon the present voyage with the only one and all engrossing object of hunting the white whale, close quote. And Ahab's vengeance will not, in the end, be visited upon that whale, but upon the firm. For Moby Dick escapes after smashing and sinking the ship. Yet the drowning of the Pequod and nearly all of its men leaves no lasting stain upon this capitalist design. In hiring a maddened captain to head up already dangerous work, the Pequod's directors played with fire, but they did not really get burned. They and the other investors enjoy the retardant of diversification and insurance. Indeed, if ships never sink, that may be evidence that their crews are too risk-averse from a profit maximization perspective. Moby Dick chronicles a catastrophe for the sailors and their families. But to the stockholders, it just ledgers the cost of doing business. The corporate tragedy of Captain Ahab. Having witnessed that the sinking of the Pequod was a corporate affair, come now to the little lower layer and see the corporate causes of the wrecking of that legendary man who lost that miserable ship, Captain Ahab. The separation of ownership and control in whaling vessels was measured by thousands of miles, with no chance for ongoing oversight by the owners on land over the managers at sea. It was therefore especially important to have a skillful, loyal chief executive officer in command of a whaling vessel. As we have seen, Ahab instead exploits his position to advance his own private interest, vengeance, rather than pursuing the corporate purpose of the Pequod. What I want to emphasize here is that it is the corporate form that enables the disloyal Ahab to do so much damage, not just to the ship and the men he commands, but also to himself. Ahab does not own the Pequod. Maybe if he did, he would have stayed more focused on the hunt or been more cautious about the dangers of pursuing that white whale. Our own well-being, the good maintenance of our own soul and heart, can be hard to track and manage. But hearing the creaking of one's owned timbers, or seeing the tearing of one's owned sails, can give some focus to ideas about what really is in one's best interest and can keep the steering on a prudent course. The rattling of the Pequod in the chase of Moby Dick does not wake Ahab from his private nightmare, for it is not his vessel that strains. Ahab is alienated from the ship's time, supplies, and timbers, and through this alienation is freed into his unmoored, destructive fancies. Being the manager of other people's money rather than his own creates an agency problem not just for the ship's owners, but for Ahab himself. Footnote: here I showcase the ways in which corporate law facilitates Ahab's ruin. For a different but certainly related analysis, see C.L.R. James's brilliant treatment of Ahab as representing a proto-totalitarian revolt against democracy and capitalism in Mariners, Renegades, and Castaways, 1953, written while James was imprisoned on Ellis Island. Back to the text. Anyone can fantasize about big deviance, but with the power of the corporation, those fantasies can be made into self-destructive reality. No one person could or rationally would own outright a ship as big and capable as the Pequod. Ahab in a dinghy on a private fishing trip is a threat to no one, neither to investors, nor sailors, nor to himself. Ahab at home in his easy chair, stewing over that lost leg and that damn whale, might eventually get over it. He might finally see that nothing could be done about it, and he might instead end up playing with his toddler or making with his wife a few more dents in their marital pillow. Footnote: in one mournful reflection, Ahab rues that he had sailed on a whaling job the day after marrying, leaving, quote, but one dent in my marriage pillow. Back to the text. Left to his own devices, Ahab could not bring 30 men, the ship, and himself to their immediate ruin, pursuing his mad, selfish ambition. It is the corporate form, with its means of aggregating capital, with its methods of separating ownership and control, that enables Ahab's enormous, anomalous undertaking. Beyond the ship itself, Ahab makes use of corporate knowledge and the cultural capital of the corporation to accomplish his suicidal mission. He has at his disposal the ship's books and records from many previous journeys. These track and the path of sperm whales with a granularity approaching the social media algorithms that track your movements and mind today. Ahab could not have found Moby Dick without these corporate assets. That data does not exist without the rationalizing, profit-maximizing imperatives driving whaling ventures. Without this corporate knowledge to misappropriate, Ahab would be left to search for the white whale only in his corrupted mind. Imagination can be dangerous, but not so dangerous as imagination mixed with corporate intelligence. Ahab also takes advantage of the rules of corporate governance to bring disadvantage to himself. The law prescribes profit maximization, but under the business judgment rule, it defers entirely to managerial discretion regarding the means of pursuing that end. Among the discretionary customs of whale hunting that Ishmael is giddy to praise is the gam. When two whaling vessels pass each other on the open sea, they often stop and have a gam. The sailors come aboard each other's ships to socialize, often with drink. Footnote: these gams might last for days, giving perhaps some historical context to cushy contemporary corporate retreats. Letters were exchanged in the gams as whaling ships, get this, often carried mail from shore just in case their intended recipient was stumbled upon thousands of miles away at sea. One of the benefits of this unlikely method is that it involved no reply all option. Back to the text. Ishmael says that in gams, officers would commonly share information about where they had seen whales and where the hunting was good. In a shallow way, this seems contrary to the charge of profit maximization. The fewer whales killed by a competitor, the more valuable the oil brought to shore for one's own firm. But the business judgment rule runs deep as the sea. Convivial customs on the cruising grounds may relax and fortify the men against the lonesome burdens of the long journey and the rigors of the hunt. At one intriguing moment, it seems that the possibility of a gam might even move Ahab out of his miserable solipsism, which might dislodge his selfish mission to hunt Moby Dick. Brooding again alone, he suddenly hears a man aloft cry, "Sail ho!" The Pequod has come upon another whale ship. Quote, "Well, now that's cheering," cried Ahab, suddenly erecting himself, while whole thunderclouds swept aside from his brow. "That lively cry upon this deadly calm might almost convert a better man. Where away?" Close quote. but alas, it is not for Ahab. He forbids the Pequod from ordinary gams, not because they are frivolous, but because they are substantive. They threaten to enliven him back to the true purpose of the ship. Yet while refusing regular gams, he exploits this discretionary whaling custom in order to procure information for his sordid diversion. He calls out to passing ships for news of the white whale. If he hears none, he sails on deeper into his loneliness. But when the Pequod comes upon the Samuel Enderby, whose captain has a whalebone prosthesis for an arm, matching the one on Ahab's leg, both limbs lost to Moby Dick, Ahab calls for a gam and scampers aboard the neighboring ship. He is not looking for profitable leisure, but information on the white whale's whereabouts, which he gets. The Samuel Enderby's intelligence is available to the Pequod's captain because of corporate law, not despite it. Thus we see in Moby Dick that the latitude of the business judgment rule can become the crux upon which corporate malfeasance is leveraged. We see, too, that it can serve as the feckless agent's gateway to a deeper depravity. Any single soul lost can tilt at windmills. But if you want to tangle with Leviathan, you're going to need a crew. To stand up against an awful whale, you're going to need men who are committed to following the dictates of your command. Ronald Coase explained in The Nature of the Firm that among the most powerful features of corporate organization is the authority it bestows on managers to dictate to workers just what they will do and how they will do it. A worker's engagement with the firm is contracted at a price, but within the day-to-day affairs of the business, quote, if a workman moves from department Y to department X, he does not go because of a change in relative prices, but because he is ordered to do so. Close quote, Ronald Coase, The Nature of the Firm. Ahab limping alone into a Nantucket bar, looking to rally a crew to hunt the whale that wounded him, would be laughed at. The Saturday night crowd would have seen him for a madman, bought him a drink, had some song, and they and Old Thunder, too, would have gone home to kiss their sleeping children. Ahab uses the fiction of the corporation to get good men to go along with his terrible plot. With the customs attendant to his agency, Ahab, quote, masked himself, incidentally making use of them for other and more private ends than they were legitimately intended to subserve. Close quote. Melville understands how crucial the cultural capital of the workplace is to exercising the corporate power that Coase identified. For, quote, for be a man's intellectual superiority what it will, it can never assume the practical, available supremacy over other men without the aid of some sort of external arts and entrenchments, always in themselves more or less paltry and base. Close quote. Without the forms and usages of the sea, Ahab could not have gotten the men to do his bidding. Being not Ahab but Captain Ahab, and salting his inducement with the promise of a gold doubloon bonus for the man who spots the white whale, and plying the men with a little alcohol, Ahab easily wins the ship's sub-agents over to his self-destructive plot. With the Pequod's crew at his disposal, Ahab can fully torment himself until he is finally not just lonesome, but lost. The self-preserving mission of loyalty. The corporation and corporate law thus enables Ahab's wrecking of his soul before he wrecks the Pequod. However, the same corporate lens that we use to diagnose this catastrophe also suggests a pathway to redemption that might have saved Ahab and might yet protect us readers from the Ahab in ourselves. as we witness the threat that Ahab's agency poses to himself, we can also see the rescue that the dictates of agency law offered to him. We can see through Ahab's tragedy that the function of the duty of loyalty is not only to protect the corporation from the agent, but to protect the agent from themselves, and to keep the agent from being corrupted by the powers of the agency. The duty of loyalty requires thought of the self to be renounced, and this can be a blessed abnegation. At one point, the oil casks in the Pequod's hull were leaking. So the scrupulous first mate, Starbuck, reports it to Ahab. The only thing to do, Starbuck advises, is to stop the ship, raise the Burtons, a pulley used to lift the heavy casks, and set into repairs. Ahab at first insists that they stay on course after Moby Dick. Quote, let it leak. I'll not have the Burtons hoisted. Starbuck flashes the black letter. Quote, what will the owners say, sir? Ahab. Let the owners stand on Nantucket Beach and out-yell the typhoons. What cares Ahab? Owners. Owners. Thou art always prating to me, Starbuck, about those miserly owners, as if the owners were my conscience. But look ye, the only real owner of anything is its commander. And hark ye, my conscience is in this ship's keel. On deck. Footnote. Among corporate law scholars, even proponents of shareholder primacy agree it is a mistake to think of shareholders as owners of the corporation. See Stephen Bainbridge. Rather, it is better to say they are the residual claimants of the firm, entitled to the full concern of the directors within corporate governance. To say shareholders are owners obscures more than it reveals, because shareholders have none of the traditional indicia of ownership, such as the right to control or the right to occupy and exclude, which actually comes closer to the privileges Ahab has on the Pequod. Starbuck says to remember the owners, but Ahab finds it easy to avoid that injunction, since these shareholders are not really anything like owners, and Ahab himself looks more like an owner than they do. If Starbuck had better corporate theory, he might have been better able to address Ahab to his responsibilities. As it is, Ahab uses the confusion to evade his duty. Back to the text. When Starbuck hesitates, Ahab threatens him with violence. Now Starbuck takes his warning about Ahab abandoning his agency duties to the lower layer. He draws down from Ahab's fiduciary duty of loyalty to the Pequod into a deeper conceit, warning Ahab about the disloyalty of his own soul, and calling him to discipline his corrupted agent back to his principal's purpose. Quote, thou hast outraged me, not insulted me, sir. But for that I ask thee not to beware of Starbuck. Thou wouldst but laugh. But let Ahab beware of Ahab. Beware of thyself, old man. Close quote. Starbuck is warning the principal agent. Starbuck is warning the principal Ahab that his agent, Ahab, is driving his corporate soul to ruin. Melville gets to this powerful ethical invocation through a conception of corporate duties. The formulation immediately strikes Ahab as insightful. Quote, what's that he said? Ahab, beware of Ahab. There's something there. Close quote. The call to loyalty, to the ship, to himself, relieves Ahab for a moment from his narcissistic designs. He comes on deck and gives the order to stop the ship and make repairs. Quote, furl the gallant sails and close reef the top sails, fore and aft, up Burton, and break out into the main hold. Close quote. Ahab's renewed fidelity to the shareholders and to himself quickly passes. He wants it to pass. His madness does, anyway. And one way he gets it to pass is by forbidding Starbuck from making further reports to him. Because no officer can be everywhere at once, corporate law imposes on directors and officers a duty to hear reports about the business. Quote, the board must make a good faith effort, that is, try to put in place a reasonable board-level system of monitoring and reporting, close quote. That's Marchand versus Barnhill, Delaware Supreme Court, 2019. To stay disloyal and maintain his malign purpose, Ahab has to reject this wise dictate of corporate governance that would threaten to make him well. Ahab sees, as we can now see, that the deeper purpose of this command to hear reports is not just to inform the corporate officer of happenings in the business, but also to continually make salient the fact of their obligations to the firm, lest their mind wander in some other direction. It is not enough for Ahab to hear reports and ignore them. The very hearing of reports threatens, promises, to stoke fiduciary loyalty and personal healing in Ahab. So Ahab has to stop hearing them. To keep on his selfish task, Ahab must deeply isolate from others. Quote, in this matter of the whale, be the front of thy face to me as the palm of this hand, a lipless, unfeatured blank, close quote. It is an eerie image. Starbuck's face as a palm. Ahab makes Starbuck mute so he can listen only to the lonely sorrow echoing in his own head. This lonesomeness Ahab will now suffer to the very last. For as the Pequod finally sinks, Ahab is not even on it with his crew. He is on his own whaleboat, watching from afar. Quote, death, glorious ship, must ye then perish, and without me? Am I cut off from the last fond pride of meanest shipwrecked captain? Close quote. Only loyal captains get to go down with the ship. Disloyal ones stand alone, watching as it all happens. The corporation is the occasion of Ahab's malfeasance and facilitates it. But the fiduciary law of the corporation also provides an ethics that might have saved Ahab from himself and the rest of the crew too. In this insight, we can see the hint of a broader outline of personal ethics inspired by a corporate conception. Melville is alert to this deeper idea. He sees the practical relationship between corporate organization and destruction, exploitation and death. This is clear. But he also sees more deeply in the corporation an idea about life that is tender, vitalizing, and rescuing to the lost soul within Ahab and all of us. This will conclude part one of this audio recording of Moby Dick as corporate catastrophe. Please see the next episode in this podcast series for part two, which will take us right through to the conclusion. Thank you for listening to this first part. Again, you can contact me through my website and find all of my writings at davidyosefon.com. See you in part two of Moby Dick as corporate catastrophe.